Hi, this is Robert Scheer with another edition of Scheer Intelligence, where the intelligence comes from my guests, and in this case, no question, I think maybe one of the top two or three political writers we have in this country now, Thomas Frank, most famous, and I always blow the titles of books, but what is the Kansas book about and the title?
It's called What's the Matter with Kansas, and it's about the sort of rise of the culture war right.
Yeah, and that's the book that I think made you, clearly brought you to great prominence. And you've gone on with a number of books. I'm not going to go into all that now because I want to hype, actually, let me use the word. I want to get people to read your current book. And let's talk about it. The title itself is interesting. It's The People Know. And as I understand it, it's a play on a Carl Sandburg, for people who don't remember Carl Sandburg, the people's poet. When I was growing up, he was the most famous popular poet. And he wrote The People, Yes. And he also was famous for a poem on Chicago, which again celebrated the strength of the populace of the, and he was brought up the whole populist tradition in America, particularly the period at the just before the turn of the 20th century, 1895 around, when populism was popular. And so this is a book where you are basically in this fraught moment where Donald Trump, a pretend populist of the right, has been defeated, but almost 72 million Americans voted for him, and he's been derided. And most recently, the word populism came into play in an interview with Barack Obama about his new book, A Promised Land, in which Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic, used it derisively again, once again, this idea of populism. And the account I saw, Obama said the populist wave was ignited by Sarah Palin, whose rallies, quote, hinted at the degree to which appeals around identity politics, around nativism, conspiracies were gaining traction. So populism has been given a bad name. And your book is basically a celebration of what you think is really the most important strain in American democracy, the democratic experiment, which is an anti-elitism, which asserts that the common folk, farmers, workers, people who are not products of the elite school, actually should have their say, and they contain the basic font of wisdom. A kind of a Jeffersonian version as opposed to a Hamilton one.
That is exactly right. You are exactly right, Mr. Bob Scheer.
The whole point is to get people to read the book.
So yeah. Well, let's see. Where should we start? Carl Sandburg, yes, he wrote this great book-length poem in 1936 called The People, Yes, and it is a celebration of the way ordinary people talk and the kind of work that they do and the way they view the world and all those sorts of things. But that was a great decade for that kind of thing. They called him the people's poet, as you mentioned. And I think of the 1930s as the decade of the common man. It was that kind of symbolism was, and that kind of talk was everywhere in American culture and in American politics in those days. And it is funny how far we have gone from then. I mean, when I say in culture and politics, I mean in politics, Franklin Roosevelt, the New Deal, in the economy, organized labor. This was their great decade. In the arts, you think about the WPA murals that are always showing, ordinary working class people from all different racial backgrounds, engaged in some massive industrial project. Or you think of the movies of someone like Frank Capra, which are all about the genius of the common people, and how far we have gone from that. That today, you open up something like The Atlantic magazine, and populism is this dreadful phenomenon, this thing to be deplored. It's paranoia, it's anti-intellectualism, it's all these appeals to to bad motivations in humans. And of course, it's always defined as being Donald Trump. That's populism. And I'm here to say that that is not the case at all. That the correct definition, populism is a great thing, a hopeful thing. Populism is, you know, when ordinary people come together and work for economic democracy. That's the definition of the word, and it's something that we should be aspiring for, not something that we should be fearful of and trying to stamp out.
Let me just say something about that personally. I think that you have hit upon the most underappreciated factor of American life, which is about its liberation of individuals from the confinement of class and the assumption. And yes, the founders were flawed in their vision. Yes, there were a lot of contradictions, so white males and property owners were benefited, but throughout, and others were excluded, I don't want to minimize it in any way, but there was an assumption. I know it inspired me as a kid in the Bronx, with garment worker parents, you know, working in factories. My father was a knitter mechanic, keeping knitting machines going and so forth. And I remember at that time being most inspired by Tom Paine.
Yeah.
And the idea that this guy who had come over from England and was working as a corseter's apprentice or something. He had all these like kind of crummy jobs, but he could get someone who had a letter press and publish a pamphlet, and that informed the whole revolution. And I read about Tom Paine in a pamphlet that was designed for workers, and I was pleasantly surprised at the end of your marvelous book. And I say marvelous because it captures a reality I experienced as a kid. I was born in 1936 at the height of the Great Depression. Franklin Delano Roosevelt was a god in my family. And I remember thinking at that time, I was inspired by Tom Paine, that anybody could write. Anybody could read, anybody could understand. And that wisdom came to me by somebody you celebrate at the end of your book, but you identify with the populist tradition, Emanuel Haldeman Julius.
Yeah.
And he published something that ended up being published in 500 million copies around
yes,
the world.
Yes.
And they were little blue books, the Haldeman Julius little blue books. I bring it up because, you know, I just thought there was such a vitality to that. And I remember reading about Tom Paine, but I also remember reading about Plato. And the reason I bring it up is that the attack on populism is an attack on a really uninformed basis that assumes that it was anti-intellectual, that it was against deep thought, it was against ideas. No, it was against the idea that working people could not entertain deep thought and deep ideas.
Exactly.
And there I, as a kid, my father gave me a pamphlet not only on Tom Paine, but he gave me one on Plato, published by Haldeman Julius, and told me to read it when I was just a kid, and that my father was a factory worker. So why don't you bring up that sort of an expectation that ordinary people could have big ideas and be responsible, and the current meritocracy, the elitism, that to my mind is the power of your book.
Yes.
It is an attack on what has happened to liberalism, its abandonment of trade unions, of working people, an embrace of a technocratic elitism that dominates really the Democratic Party. And then, as you point out in your book, on the Republican side, they have a faux populism, and they now invoke images of populism and anti-elite power to justify basically the same crowd that the Democrats are justifying, which is big concentrated wealth on Wall Street, Silicon Valley, etc.
Yes. Oh my God, Bob Scheer, how am I ever going to, that is one hell of a question. But let's talk about it. It certainly is. Let's just start, you know, Tom Paine, the greatest, you know, one of the greats of the founding fathers. I just want to, I don't really talk a whole lot about the founding fathers of this country in the book, but I do want to emphasize that there is something profoundly democratic about America and has been since the very beginning in a way that you don't see in any other country in the world or any other country that I am familiar with. that, you know, even though, of course, in those days when they wrote the Declaration and the Constitution, only a small, tiny minority of the population was even allowed to vote. Slavery was legal and was practiced by a whole lot of these guys, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Someone like Tom Paine reminds us, and the things that he was saying in the 1770s, reminds us that the democratic impulse has been here all along in that populist pamphleteering tradition. Now, the Populist Party was, the word was actually made up. Let's talk for a second about where the word comes from. It was actually, you know, it's not just a word that fell from the skies that we get to use however we want. The word was consciously invented by an American political movement in the 1890s. It was a classic farmer labor movement with the emphasis on farmers. And it was, the word was made up. It's close to my heart because it was made up on a train traveling between Kansas City and Topeka. And I'm from Kansas City, and I've spent a lot of time in my life in Topeka. And this is where the word was made up. And it was invented in 1891 to describe this farmer labor movement that was then coming up and starting to challenge the other two parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party. This was the Populist Party was the last great effort to launch a third party in this country. And it was, of course, supposed to be a left-wing party. And it was a left-wing party that was based not on, you know, having the president of Harvard University sit in your cabinet and tell everybody what to do and having a whole lot of fancy technocrats here in Washington, D.C., sort of twisting the dials. It was a party that was based on the idea that ordinary people understood their situation and understood their predicament, and that ordinary people, you know, are the ones who are best placed to understand what's going on in the country, because there's, you know, obviously it's their business to understand that. Populism was not anti-intellectual, regardless of what everybody says about the way everybody uses the word today, but it did defy the orthodoxies of its age. The great orthodoxy of that time was the great economic orthodoxy was the gold standard. You couldn't, you know, how dare you question the gold standard? It could not be done. But populism did. Populism dared to say we should get off the gold standard and have a modern, you know, currency that is determined by, where the value is determined by the government rather than by the price of a precious metal. And the populists, you know, went against the, you know, Ivy League economists of their time when they said this. And yes, they were a bunch of cranks out on the prairie, but the joke is ultimately on the elites because the populists were right about this stuff. Let's talk about the pamphlets for a second, if it's okay with you, Bob. The populists loved pamphlets. They would set up these lending libraries of their sort of populist movement literature, which included all kinds of different left-wing authors and different, you know, thinkers, and it included people like Tom Paine. And one of the newspapers, populism was a movement of newspapers. Every small town in the plains, by the way, this was true in California as well. Not so much in the Bronx, I don't think, but in big parts of the country, populist newspapers would challenge the mainstream media of their day. And one of the most successful populist newspapers was called The Appeal to Reason. And it was published in a small town in Kansas called Girard, Kansas. And it later, when populism died, the newspaper went over to the Socialist Party and became this enormous socialist publishing operation. It's not, you know, remembered much anymore, but it had a circulation in the hundreds of thousands, which is kind of extraordinary. And anyhow, when socialism died, the publisher of the paper, who was the guy you mentioned before, Haldeman Julius, the publisher of this newspaper said, well, what am I going to do? You know, I've got this huge printing plant. I've got all these employees. I've got this great capacity. What am I going to do? And he hit on the idea of, you know, sort of going back to the populist pamphleteering, the populist mania for pamphlets. They loved pamphlets. And he started issuing pamphlets. He started out doing your sort of classics of the left. But then he branched out and just did classics of world literature, classics of philosophy. You know, you mentioned Plato. He put out Goethe. He put out Schopenhauer, you know, in these pamphlets that cost 5 cents. And they were 5 cents a piece. So you would mail him a dollar to his headquarters in Girard, Kansas, tell him which ones you want, and he would send you 20 of these booklets, you know, in a box. And it was an incredible success. These pamphlets went all over the world. Well, you know this, Bob. You were telling me earlier about how you read them when you were young.
Well, let me just put a footnote on that, by the way. My family, my father was a German Protestant. It was a family of welders and machinists and so forth. And my mother's family were also working in garment working, basically the working class. And they were from Lithuania and they were Jewish. And I was born in 36, and it was, you know, fascism and issues and what Germany was going to do to Russia came to be, unfortunately, one of the great tragedies of human history. And yet on both sides of my family, they were progressive, they were enlightened, they were anti-fascist, including the German Protestants and a few Catholics in that group. And I think the library, the total library in both houses were these Haldeman and Julius pamphlets. So here you had two ethnically different groups. I would go from one to the other, and the reading library, I mean, I only, you know, came to think a lot about it when I finished your book, because you have Haldeman Julius at the end as a denial that populism means being anti-intellectual. Because my relatives, and it's not true you didn't have it in the Bronx, you say.
No, I'm sorry, Bob. I conflate. There's two different things. There's the populist, the political movement in the 1890s, and which caught on basically everywhere in the country except for the Northeast.
But you still had many newspapers. Your point was people challenging the establishment. When I was growing up, of course, 40 years later, in New York City, you had like 25 newspapers, and quite a few of them were on the left and some were on the right. But there was no question that they were challenging the orthodoxies and the elite. And I want to get to that.
Let me interject. That's populism. Not like, you know, Sarah Palin peddling conspiracy theories or something like that, but what you just described, when you have all these different voices and you have people trying to, you know, saying that, well, challenging the orthodoxies and saying that, you know, knowledge cannot just be monopolized by higher education. It can't just be monopolized by people that went to fancy schools. This is a democracy. It has to be the property of everyone. It has to be accessible to everyone. That's what they were saying.
Well, I want to get from that to a really provocative point in your book, not that the other isn't, but the whole eradication of class, of ordinary people, and this idea that somehow only through a certain kind of elite education and meritocracy will we get leadership? That becomes the big challenge. And it's interesting because in your book, you mentioned Seymour Martin Lipset, a well-known sociologist. I happened to be a graduate student at Berkeley when he was a professor there. And some of us were really admirers of C. Wright Mills, who certainly introduced notions of class in reading. But Seymour Martin Lipset, who had come out of this kind of left working class background in New York City and so forth, was denying it now, and others. Meanwhile, you had Michael Harrington and other great writers asserting it. And one of the really interesting things in your book is your discussion of the civil rights movement and the role of labor and labor unions in making America a better place. That, in fact, and you bring up this question of professional economists. Well, the New Deal, where Franklin Delano Roosevelt was basically attacked by most of the professional economists and the elite.
Yes.
And places like where I went to school, City College in New York, we didn't respect Harvard. We knew they were a sellout for the elite, and we were going to get it straight, you know, and we had professors who would challenge that narrative, you know, and then some became neoconservatives and ended up betraying that tradition. But you have gotten hold of really the most important challenge of the democratic experiment. What is the role of the mass of people? Deriding the mass of the people, the attack on the very idea of democracy and surrendering it to the meritocracy is the strength of your book. And I want people to read it because in no place was that clearer than what happened with a Barack Obama. that, first of all, under Bill Clinton, you really have the shift of the Democratic Party. In the Republican Party, that was clear. They were for the plutocracy. They were for Wall Street. But it was Bill Clinton who ushered in the deregulation of Wall Street,
yeah,
and really created the basis for the great housing meltdown, the great recession. That's one marker in it. And the whole argument was the smart people know what they're doing. Lawrence Summers, in congressional testimony attacking Brooksley Bourne, a member of the administration who really sounded the alarm,
yeah,
about this deregulation, attacked it. They know what they're doing. He was getting $6 million a year from Wall Street at one point as an advisor to Dee Shaw Company and so forth. But the whole professionalism of the meritocracy, we're going to select the best and the brightest, and then we're going to get them to think to defend us, defend power, and so forth. And with Barack Obama, you have the personification of that in that administration, because the bailout of Wall Street, the surrendering of Main Street, was really the theme of 08. And so why don't we talk a little bit about that, what you call the historic inversion, and how elitism came to define liberal and Democratic Party politics, and then this absurd parody of populism comes to define the Republican Party.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly where we are today. You know, Bob, I've been talking about issues of economics and social class my whole career, and I have never felt more less optimistic about my message getting through. Nowadays, if people think there's something, you know, wrong with you if you even talk about this, it's not even like part of, you know, I live here in Bethesda, Maryland, this affluent suburb of Washington, D.C. And one of the things, and I know you know what I'm talking about here, these yard signs that you see that try to list all the liberal causes to be as comprehensive, you know, and to the people who live around me, it's very natural that the affluent and the highly educated would be the rank and file of liberalism. That makes perfect sense to them. You know, that's what liberalism is. It is an appeal to the smartest, the most able, the best members of society. And they have these yard signs that describe, that try to comprehensively give a little shout out to all the different branches of what they take to be the liberal faith. And so it'll say, like, these are all things I agree with, by the way. They'll say things like women's rights are human rights. No human is illegal. Respect science or whatever. Science is truth or something like that. Water is life. You know, like a whole, but all these different issues. But they never say anything about work or working class people, or, you know, like that every job should be a middle class job, or, you know, every, you know, the minimum wage should be $15, or, you know, something like that, or like everyone should have health care. They don't mention these things. It's as though that has been deleted from the liberal consciousness. And it's just natural and normal to liberals now that's not part of liberalism. That's something else. That's not part of the left. You know, the left is about being really, really moral and being really, really good and being really highly educated and knowing the buzzwords and knowing the science and keeping everybody else out. That's what liberalism is. And when I try to explain to them, you know, this is why I had to write this book, by the way, the Book of Populism, because populism, the populist tradition in America is the tradition of, you know, of working class politics. The populist party that I mentioned before in the 1890s was emphatically about working class people and taking a stand against industrialization, against plutocracy, you know, against the corruption and the concentration of wealth in the 1890s. That's what they were all about. And that's what, and you know this is true, Bob, as you look around, you know, that's what parties of the left all over the world used to be about. You know, respecting science, sure, of course. You know, water is life. Yeah, I mean, yeah, we don't like pollution. But to just delete what used to be essential, you know, to delete that part of the identity, to delete the populist aspect of the left is, that is where we are today. And I'm afraid that it is a recipe for disaster.
time for a break, and we'll be back in a few minutes. We're back with Sheer Intelligence and our guest.
Well, it's not just a recipe for disaster, ultimately, electorally, and so forth, because you're alienating. You know, there are still almost 72 million people voted for Donald Trump. And if you think they're all deplorables, the way Hillary Clinton described them,
yeah,
you're running, you know, you're dismissing half this. Actually, just, you know, Biden got supposedly the most votes anyone has ever gotten. Trump got the second most votes. But you know, what's interesting about this is there's a conceit that informs it that your book unmasks. And the assumption is the masses get it wrong. And therefore, you have to have an elite. And yes, the elite should be drawn with the best and the brightest from the masses as well as from the people of privilege. And there should be opportunity, a level playing field, and so forth, you know, and what have you. But that somehow excellence is what you want to reward. That's the assumption of the meritocracy.
Yeah.
And what your book unmasks so clearly and applies to the argument about populism is actually the people who were derided unfairly as being anti-intellectual, which they weren't.
Yeah.
And that's why I bring up the Haldeman and Julia's pamphlets. There was a great emphasis on knowledge, on studying the experience of others, of getting informed. These people wanted more public education. They wanted more money spent on educating the working class,
yes,
and so forth. But the conceit is somehow the elite, technological elite, professional elite, they get it right. Well, they got it wrong about the populace because the populace thought the gold standard was madness.
Yep.
And yet the economics profession thought it was absolutely necessary to stability. In fact, it was holding back spending money on things that needed to be spent. It was holding back on notions of fairness and equality and opportunity. And now, if you argue for the gold standard, you're Ron Paul or somebody. You know, you're considered a nutcase,
yeah,
you know, and that's what the populace did. But I want to take this on, this meritocracy thing, because I think you're dead right here. Yeah, first of all, I never had met any working person, and I certainly, coming from that kind of background and had my own share of jobs that I didn't particularly like, who didn't welcome technology. I worked in the post office for, you know, all through college and as every single working day, and that's how I went to college. And boy, I tried to invent the zip codes. I was an engineering student by that point. I had all sorts of ideas of how you could make the post. I've never met anybody working in a supermarket, working in a factory, who didn't think. My own father loved machinery. You know, he was a machinist, yeah, and he loved figuring out better ways to produce things so you didn't have to use labor. Labor has never been against technology. What they're against is technology that replaces their value. And if it replaces their value, there ought to be a method of compensation.
Exactly.
Okay, that's really the issue in all of these trade agreements. You know, send the jobs elsewhere, but don't send it because those people are working for next to nothing. And one of the ironies, by the way, is in Donald Trump's rewrite of NAFTA, there is actually for the first time some protection of labor. And if you're in Mexico and you're assembling cars, 45% of the cars has to be paid, the workers have to be paid $16 an hour. It's not enough. You know, but it's a start. And the irony is these trade agreements did not factor in environmental protection, but didn't factor in working protection. We now are using all these gadgets from China. We're thrilled. Chinese production is back on track. Apple could come out with one line after another, very successful. And as your book mentions, really, no one cares about what are we paying workers in the Apple plants? What right do they have? And you mentioned about those lawn signs. Why aren't there, you even gave me an example in your book from a young woman in school. Everybody's talking about what's important. She holds up,
yes,
labor.
Yes.
Why isn't there a demand now, instead of pushing around China because they're going to steal our secrets through TikTok or something, when we have led the world in surveillance technology, of course, why is there no demand that China meet our minimum wage, or that they have a decent standard of pay,
yeah,
or that their workers have the right to form unions? You know, that doesn't even come up. You know, that's not even considered a human right internationally, that you have the right to organize into a union, or free speech to defend workers' rights, or the right to a minimum wage. You know, and I think that is the power of your book. You cut through this basic conceit that the elite, first of all, gets it right. They don't get it right. But David Halberstam wrote the best, had the best title of a book about Vietnam, The Best and the Brightest.
Yeah.
And the elite there, it was Robert McNamara, as you mentioned in your book, who brought in this whole idea of the professional technocratic class. Well, his best and the brightest got it all wrong, you know, and they got it all wrong about banking deregulation under Clinton.
Yes.
And they got it all wrong about how to save the economy in the Great Recession under Obama, because they went to Wall Street. The great, you know, revelation of Julian Assange, who's now sitting in prison in England, waiting for extradition, maybe the Democrats will finally get their hands on him, was what Hillary Clinton told Goldman Sachs. I have to go back to Washington to fix these problems, and I need the smart people in this room to go with me. That was the whole argument. You know, so I think the conceit, A, that the best and the brightest actually get it right is not true. You know, we've had one disastrous era after another. And the other is that somehow empowering ordinary people means a loss of quality and smartness and accountability, when just the opposite is the case. In your book, you point out example after example. So give us some of those examples.
Okay. So, wow. This is a huge subject. This is the subject of the book, and it's hard to put it all in one, you know, to
take encapsulate. Your time. We can go longer. Okay. And at least one, and you've mentioned that NPR and PBS, and they don't have you back, and television doesn't have
you. Yeah, they're not interested anymore. Yeah.
Okay. At least for this week, I can't guarantee it will go on forever.
Okay.
But I will go as long as you want to tell us about this, I think, really important book. And it will be on KCRW, the NPR station that's one of the most famous in the country. And it will be picked up elsewhere. So,
okay, fantastic.
You have a megaphone right now.
All right, here I go. So I mentioned what populism actually was. And so your listeners are probably saying, well, how did the word get flipped? How did it come to mean, remember that quote that you gave at the very start of the show, how did it come to mean paranoid, racist, anti-intellectual? How did it come to mean that? And the answer is that in the 1950s, there was a sort of generation of scholars. You mentioned Seymour Martin Lipset. He was one of them. They were this was the consensus school of intellectuals. And these guys, some of them had, like Lipset, had been involved with organized labor, but as a group, they became immensely suspicious of working class movements for a lot of different reasons, bad reasons, basically. They decided that McCarthyism was a working class movement, which it was not. But they became really frightened by the prospect of mass movements of working class people. And they decided that mass movements of working class people were, by their nature, authoritarian, anti-intellectual, demagogic, foolish. They did everything wrong, racist, xenophobic, you know, right down the line. And the word that they started to use to describe these mass movements was populism. Now, this was the reason they started doing that was because of a famous work of history that came out in the 1950s that said that's what the populist movement was in the 1890s. That work of history turned out to be completely wrong. It was debunked by other historians. It's a very famous story in the if you go to graduate school and study American history, this guy famously got populism exactly wrong.
Well, mention this, Richard Hofstadter.
It's Richard Hofstadter, the most famous historian of that period. But his redefinition of the word and the way that he turned the word into a generic word meaning mass movements of working class people that are xenophobic, anti-intellectual, et cetera, that caught on. And so people like Seymour Lipset were using it. Daniel Bell was using it. Edward Schills was using it. And their argument was that all movements of working class people, all mass movements of working class people were similarly dangerous.
You know, even when they said they weren't dangerous, like you take something like organized labor in the 1950s, which said it was anti-racist and said it was, you know, that it was very, you know, civically minded. And in fact, it was, you know, but they said, no, even though they say that and even though they are that, we can do these personality studies of their members and discover that, in fact, they harbor these really ugly sentiments. And in fact, they're guilty of all these terrible things, even though they say they aren't. And in fact, they really aren't. We can still say that they are. And this is Lipset's famous essay. What is it called? I've actually got a copy of it right here. I'm going to look it up. I'm going to flip it open to that chapter. And it was called Working Class Authoritarianism. That was the argument. Working class authoritarianism, basically, that's what working class politics always is. And that's a really pessimistic way to think about we the people. You know, in this country that had this great tradition, this Tom Paine tradition, this Haldeman Julius tradition of believing in the intelligence of the common man, all of a sudden we're saying, no, these people are dangerous. They're puppets in the hands of a slick demagogue. They're authoritarian. And why did they say this? Why did this catch on? Why is this such a powerful idea? Because it was also flattering to a different group of people. It was insulting to, you know, ordinary Americans, but it was very flattering to a different group. And that group was, of course, the sort of managerial class, the professional class. It was just then starting to feel its power in American life. You mentioned Robert McNamara. He was kind of the poster boy for this class. He was the great genius behind the Ford Motor Company. They put him in charge of the Pentagon. He could run the Vietnam War with a big computer. He could deliver victory over communism without, you know, actually, you know, all through this, his mastery of these amazing managerial techniques of the 1950s and 1960s. And similarly, the argument was that managerialism could deliver prosperity. It could deliver, well, it could deliver whatever you chose, as long as you put people like Hofstadter, Daniel Bell, Lipset, you know, all of this generation of intellectuals, you had to put them in charge. Once they were in charge in Washington, once you had experts and leaders and lobbyists and people with PhDs and people with MBAs sitting around the big mahogany table in Washington, D.C., then you'd get results. Then you'd get reform. Then you'd get social progress. So the idea was that populism, this appeal to the masses, this appeal to the common man, this appeal to the working class, you couldn't do that anymore. If you wanted progress, if you wanted reform, if you wanted to win the war against communism, you couldn't do that anymore. You had to put the managerial class in charge. And so it is the meritocratic class, the people who scored well on the SATs, the people who understood how the world worked. They had to run things, not mass movements of working class people. And just to put the message of, you know, that's the attitude and the philosophy that dominates the Democratic Party today. That's the attitude and the philosophy that gave us the Vietnam War, that gave us the housing bubble, and that gave us the financial crisis, and that gave us the Wall Street bailouts, et cetera, and gave us the opioid epidemic. You know, those pills didn't prescribe themselves, you know. And so the message of my book is that this philosophy is entirely upside down, is entirely backwards, and is entirely wrong. And the real genius of America still resides in the hearts of ordinary people, the rank and file, the common man. And the government by geniuses, they always wind up they act as a class, Robert, you know this. They act as a class. They help each other out. They give each other, they get each other off the hook when they get in trouble. They bail one another out. They make sure that their colleagues never face any consequences. And they also endlessly tune out the voices of the common people, always. So that's the whole nature of professional economics, that they don't have to listen to voices from outside their profession. That's the nature of political science. They don't have to listen to you. You know, they only have to listen to one another. And this is a philosophy of government and a philosophy for running a society that is so profoundly misguided And nevertheless, that is, my word for it is anti-populism. And yet that anti-populism is precisely what is, you know, the dominant philosophy in the Democratic Party today, the party that you and I, Bob, have spent our lives supporting and, you know, cheering for. Okay, I have anyways. I know you hate it when I say things like that. I'm sorry.
Well, you hate it? No, I don't hate it. It's true. I have voted for the lesser evil.
I know.
All of my life. But let me, I want to make a point about this because, again, listeners, okay, we've had this big menace of Donald Trump, and thank God, you know, Joe Biden is now president, and hopefully, you know, he'll do a better job. You know, if not for the pandemic, by the way, I think Donald Trump would have been reelected probably by a big majority.
Yes, I think that's
because,
probably right. Yeah.
You know, he didn't get us into any new wars, and he actually, the economy seemed to help a large swath of people certainly better than his predecessors in many ways. But having said that, I think the real problem here is recognizing that this class of the elite, some of them become very rich.
Yeah.
Some of them make a lot of money. But the main group that they benefit are coupon clippers, the very same people that the populists were attacking. People who happen to have a lot of wealth and can parlay that wealth into a lot of income. And that's what happened with Bill Clinton is a very good example. I remember interviewing him when he was still governor of Arkansas, and I interviewed, you know, on the eve of his, winning the nomination. And I met his mother. I met a lot of people around him. And the fact is, Bill Clinton had a sense of what it was like to be poor and white in Arkansas, a very poor state. And the ticket into the meritocracy, the same for Obama, who had some reality in his life, being, having a father from Africa, who ironically I spoke at an anti-war thing where his father
really?
Evidently spoke at, according to some clippings that I found in Honolulu.
That's amazing.
But, you know, had a reality. But the key to the meritocracy is to abandon what the people you grew up with, and to abandon what you observed. And so Bill Clinton, just like Ronald Reagan, after all, you mentioned WPA, his father worked for the Works Project Administration
yes.
under Roosevelt. And Ronald Reagan, in his own autobiography, Where Is the Rest of Me, or whatever it was, said, you know, without the New Deal, Roosevelt was a god in his house. Without the New Deal, they would have starved.
Yep.
Okay, which is true in my household. But the trick to the meritocracy is to forget where you came from. And what Bill Clinton did is he embraced the moneyed elite, the very people who had left Arkansas as such a mess. And he ended the main federal poverty program, the very thing Martin Luther King was fighting for, which was helping not just people of color, but of any color get a shot in life. Bill Clinton, who knew what it was like to be poor, presided over the end to the
AFDC. Yes, he did.
Aid to families with dependent children. 70% of the beneficiaries were children. A significant number were people of color. He ended it. He empowered the banks through deregulation and let them go do their business. So the problem is with the intellectual elite is that they get these handouts from the foundations and the big money, but they also serve the interests of the most powerful. And one of the poignant
yes.
examinations in your book, and maybe we'll wrap it up with that, is the idea that somehow populism was at its heart racist, was anti-feminist, all of these things that's hurled against it. And your book, you document how, in fact, the situation of women because of the war and women going into the workforce was very much advanced by labor. And so is the condition of people of color, particularly by the development of the CIO, as against the old trade union basis of the AFL, and that you point out that the heart, really, of Martin Luther King's and of the civil rights movement were people like Bayard Rustin, A. Philip Randolph. In your book, you say A. Philip Randolph, the head of the Sleeping Car Porters Union, was the most important visible civil rights figure before Martin Luther King. It was Bayard Rustin who basically organized the march in Washington. They came out of the labor movement.
Yes.
And that the labor movement, you have the, for instance, the Longshore on the West Coast. You had Ford Local 600 under a guy named Carl Stiletto. These were the first big unions that opened up to people of color. And at a time when the U.S. military was segregated during World War I, black workers were being welcomed into mass industrial unions, the United Electrical Workers and so forth. So this whole idea that organized labor, that the labor movement in this country was, you know, only favored privileged white workers and was racist, and is a total distortion of history. The labor movement was the main agency for ending segregation in work opportunity well before we had the recognized civil rights movement. And Martin Luther King, who you deal with very seriously in your book, was the first person, would be the first to acknowledge that. And after all, he died defending janitors in Memphis, Tennessee, in a labor dispute in which the workers were black. Yep. So why don't we discuss that? Because the cheapest argument against populism, progressive populism, is to accuse it of an inherent racism and misogyny and whatever, that those are always thrown up against it as a convenient way of smearing it.
Well, that's I'm really glad you asked me this question. Look, you know, we'll talk about two things: the populist movement in the 1890s, the populist party, and the populist tradition, sort of that I call the populist tradition, you know, organized labor and things like that. The populist party in the 1890s was the only party of the three big parties at the time. It was the only one that had women in leadership positions, and it was the only one that endorsed women's suffrage. The other two, you know, the Republicans and Democrats did not. It would be truly bizarre to think that this was a misogynist undertaking. So in Kansas, in particular, Kansas was its biggest populism's biggest state. It's kind of hard to believe, but it was true. In Kansas, populism was very closely identified with the adventures of this woman named Mary Elizabeth Lease, who would travel around the state giving speeches. And it was regarded as pretty racy at the time. What she would say is, "You farmers need to raise less corn and more hell." And this was supposed to be shocking. Populism actually secured women's suffrage in two states, in Colorado and Idaho. This is, 30 years before women got the vote nationally. So they were way ahead of the curve on that one. And they were also, in my opinion, significantly less racist than the other two parties of their day. In fact, they did something really interesting in the southern states. It was, populism had a lot of appeal in the South, because it was, you know, obviously a region of farmers and agricultural workers. And populism had there was a black wing of the movement. The historians refer to this group as the Black Populists. And so they, you know, what they tried to, at the time, this is in the 1890s in the South, in a lot of the southern states, blacks could still vote. They hadn't been disenfranchised yet. But the sort of white rulers of the South kept a lid on the situation and kept themselves in power by manipulating racist sentiment. And the term that was used for this at the time was white solidarity. The idea being that your interests as white people.
And this is the Democratic Party.
This is the Democratic Party in the South. Yep. And the Democratic
Which
Party
was totally dominant. Totally dominant.
Absolutely dominant. Yep. And it was a one-party region, and they had a doctrine called white solidarity. The idea was that your interests as a white person, they would go to, you know, this is, again, a region where farmers are overwhelmingly the majority of the population. They're also extremely poor, and they're getting poorer, and it's getting worse all the time. And they would say to these people, your interests as white people outweigh your interests as farmers, your interests as, you know, someone who's watching their way of life get destroyed, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to keep voting for the Democratic Party. You have to put your economic interests aside and you have to keep voting for the Democratic Party. That was what the Democrats said. The populists came in with a really novel proposal, which was that your interests as farmers, as working class people, are actually more important than your interests as white people. And so therefore, you white farmers should get together with black farmers and vote for the populist party instead. And we'll get some measures enacted to, you know, we will do something to help farmers out, to help you people out. Now, this is not to say, I don't want to exaggerate this. This does not mean that they were like racially enlightened in the way we are today, or that they were anti-racist in the way that we are today. But by the standards of the 1890s, to go out there in the South and say this was extremely radical and extremely threatening to the social order of the time. And you can imagine how that played out. The sort of masters of the South, the Democratic ruling class of the South, came down on the populists like a ton of bricks. And there were, you know, the gunfights and gangs, armed gangs would go around intimidating people. You know, there was people would shoot each other all the time. And it was they defeated populism. And so to miss it, it's a long story and it's an awful story. What happened to the populist movement. But basically, to misunderstand that and think that the populists are the bad guys in that situation is just, it blows my mind that anybody could, you know, could misread history that badly. And then, you know, you take the populist tradition, what you just said about the CIO, you know, this was the great labor organizing campaign of the 1930s. And their idea was that they were going to organize everyone. The AFL had only organized craft workers, or you know, highly skilled people in you know, certain trades, and yes, a lot of the AFL unions were racist. But the CIO said, "No, we are going to organize everybody. That is the only way to do this thing." And they were, I mean, if you put aside things like the NAACP, the CIO and their unions, this is the great anti-racist force of the 1930s. You know, and they talked about it all the time. This is it's in their literature, it's in their propaganda, it's in their speeches, it's everywhere you go. This is what they were about. You know, and it's funny, I talk to audiences, well, I don't talk to too many audiences these days because of COVID, but I talk to people about this all the time, and they can't get their heads around the idea that organized labor was anti-racist. This is just, it's almost impossible for them to understand because they equate, you know, the white working class with Trumpism.
One's about, well, now I don't want anybody to have the idea that we got the whole book because this guy's a great writer. It's well documented. And I want to encourage people to get this book. It's really, you know what, I scratch my head and think, why haven't more of us written about this? Why were we so, maybe this was a big failing of the 60s left. Maybe you caught us there. Maybe we abandoned labor. Maybe we were elitist ourselves. You know, one of the charges of your book, maybe we were that baby boom generation also. I'm a little older than that, but you know, maybe they sold out ultimately, and abandoned working people in America.
Bill Clinton is the great political embodiment of that generation, and I don't think you can describe his career in any other way. You
know? Except there are a whole lot of people I run into as a journalist all over the years who are doing the right thing, working in schools, working, you know, all over. And why are they there? Because they were touched by the 60s. So let me just throw that in there, my own little editorial comment. I want to thank you, Thomas Frank. The book is The People Know, but it really is The People Yes, the old Carl Sandburg. It's called The People Know because it's about the people who are attacking the whole American history of populism, which is in the best sense as American as apple pie. I want to thank Christopher Ho at KCRW for putting these shows up. I want to thank Natasha Akimi Zapata for the introduction, Lucy Burbill for the transcription. I want to thank a shout out to Jean Stein, a great American writer and force. And she would have agreed, I think, with every word that Thomas Frank says in this book and has said today. And the JWK Foundation which is keeping her memory alive, has given us some support for these shows. And that's it for this edition of Sheer Intelligence. See you next week. Mes chagrins, mes plaisirs.